orbit with thick clouds overseas.
Just a few hundred humans have witnessed this view.
A rocket launch.
On.
But there's promise of a new age of space travel. For almost two decades, there's been a continuous human presence on the International Space Station.
You're initiating the capture. Standing by.
Today, there are over 1,400 satellites in orbit and more than 30 probes exploring the outer reaches of the solar system.
Have you ever seen anything so sexy?
And now, private companies set up by some of the world's most successful billionaires promise to dramatically open up space. They want to send us there as tourists.
It was paradise!
Launch our heavy industry into orbit.
And our environment is not just the Earth. Our environment is the solar system.
And even send some of us to colonize another planet.
It is a step towards a spacefaring civilization.
It'll come as no surprise for me to say I am a supporter of spaceflight. I think it's the most wonderful, romantic endeavor.
I'm in the Martian groove.
Pitch kick.
So I'm excited by the prospect of us becoming a spacefaring civilization.
A rocket factory.
But are these plans really possible now? And if we are now embracing the final frontier, what does this mean for the future of humanity?
3, 2, 1, 0.
The 21st century race for space. Hashtag race for space. A sunny day in Los Angeles, California.
Going to space for pleasure might sound implausible. But of the 550 or so humans that have left the Earth, a few have bought a ride as space tourists.
Brian Cox is driving through suburbs.
With private companies now promising to send many more of us to space, what will the experience be like?
We are on the way to, I think, the most famous space tourist in the world, because he was the first space tourist in the world.
How are you, Dennis?
It was paradise!
In 2001, Denis Tito paid Russia's space agency $20 million to fly into the International Space Station and spent 8 days orbiting the Earth.
I mean, really, I think actually calling him a space tourist is not doing him justice. I mean, that's an astronaut.
Wow, that's a nice house, isn't it?
Brian walks up to a grand mansion and pushes the intercom button. Slim and bold Dennis and his blonde wife answer the door together.
Hi, Brian.
Hello.
My wife, hey. Elizabeth.
So Brian. Pleasure to meet you, Brian.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Nice to show you around.
Thank you very much.
This is the drawing room. As you may have noticed, it's a very English-style house. Yeah. Two-level library.
How many space tourists have there been?
There have been seven total.
Seven?
And one person went twice. The last person, he flew in 2009.
Yeah.
And no one has flown since.
Footage of the tourists.
Like all astronauts visiting the space station today, the seven multimillionaire tourists travelled on a Russian Soyuz rocket, originally designed in the 1960s.
So this is the space room.
Yeah.
This is one of the suits I actually wore. It's not a space suit, but it's more casual.
Do you like the term? Because several people have said they don't like the term space tourism. They wish it had never been coined.
There's only one person I've ever known that likes it, and that's me.
So you like the name?
Right. But somehow they don't like it, but I accept it. I want to show you some of these pictures, you know, where you actually see the umbrella. We put a little umbrella and a straw, fake drink, of course. We weren't drinking alcohol on space. Having a lot of fun with the idea. You don't hear much about this from the professional space flyers, because they're professionals and they're astronauts and cosmonauts. But the beauty of a private space flight, you can be goofy if you want to. And there's no one to criticize you. You're paying your own bill. You're not having this trip on government money. So there's a lot more freedom.
Which part of the experience was the most powerful? Was it the views? Was it zero-G? Was it the launch?
I spent 45 minutes, typically every orbit, which was a half an orbit, looking out the porthole. And I would listen to opera, and I just never got bored looking out.
Drifting leisurely above the Earth, a patch of thick white clouds sprawled out beneath.
It was just such an awesome experience being off the planet and being one of the privileged few humans to do this. And it's never left me. I think of it every day.
An expanse of deep blue water.
Tito was able to spend tens of millions of dollars to get to space. But there are plenty more who would like to go if it were more affordable. This commercial opportunity poses some important questions.
How do you feel about space tourism? How do you feel about our resources, intellectual, technical and physical, being used initially to allow high net worth individuals to travel into space and get a view of the Earth? Is it really a stepping stone to the stars?
There's a place that's been leading the way in the development of this more affordable approach to space tourism.
Brian's on the road.
Mojave is a dusty little desert town, 2 hours outside Los Angeles. But it has a very special place in the history of aviation. Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in these skies back in the 1940s.
Doesn't feel like the kind of place that should have a speed limit, does it? Speed limit, Mach 3.
The key to bringing the price of space down is to develop a small-scale spaceship that can be landed and reused over and over again. Some of the early attempts here in the 1990s might look more at home in the wacky races. But then a local aircraft designer came up with something he called Spaceship One, a rocket-powered aeroplane designed to reach space. His name is Bert Rutan.
Ah,
hello.
Bert. Brian.
Good morning. Hello, Brian.
I really want to order the Valkyrie because it's the best plane. The XB-70 plane is an amazing thing, but I don't want ham and two eggs. A lot of people ask, why do we as the human race want to fly into space? Not fly on airliners, everyone understands that, but why do we want to push and push and push?
You know, I think it goes back, all the way back to why we are different than the animals. The animals live to survive. Humans, on the other hand, live to explore and to find out what's over that mountain. You know, Columbus took off not knowing what was there. Why aren't we out there wanting to go to the oceans on the moons of Saturn?
Rutan entered his Spaceship One into a contest called the XPRIZE, which would award $10 million to the first privately built reusable spacecraft.
A rocket streaks into the sky.
The start of space is usually defined as an altitude of 100 kilometres, 10 times higher than cruising airliners. Reaching this frontier between the Earth's atmosphere and the blackness of space, but not completing a full revolution of the Earth, is called suborbital flight. It's well below orbital missions like the International Space Station, which circles the Earth at 400 kilometres. Test pilot Brian Binney flew Spaceship One for the second flight in its 2004 XPRIZE attempt. To win, the craft had to prove its reusability by reaching space twice in 2 weeks.
The rocket ride really wakes you up. The adrenaline starts flowing.
For each flight, Spaceship One was dropped in mid-air from its mothership and lit its rocket engine.
We start out, you know, hey, this is fun, and there's fear, but it comes back to fun again.
The spaceship blasted its way vertically upwards, reaching an altitude of 102 kilometres on the first flight and 112 kilometres on the second.
By far the best part of that whole experience is when you shut that motor down.
The craft floats high above the surface of the Earth, and Brian plays with a model of the ship in zero G.
As though you step across a line, an entirely new dimension, and this instant karma of weightlessness. And it happens just like that. And you realize at that point, you know, you're in space. And it's as though somebody has pulled back a stage curtain for the benefit of your eyes only. And you look up, and there it is, this black void that is space. It's a bit of a mystery, it's a menace, but you can also sense its majesty.
The craft comes in to land in the desert.
Spaceship One scooped the XPRIZE. And Virgin entrepreneur Richard Branson struck a licensing deal with Burt Rutan's company to develop the design for a space tourism business.
How important was the XPRIZE?
Well, you know, governments haven't gotten us space travel for the people. They never tried to. They told us, but they never tried. So I had this feeling that once I did that, once I took an average of like 35 people for 3.5 years and did a manned space program, developed our own rocket motor. We bought some components for it, but we developed our own rocket motor. My feeling was that all of a sudden, now everybody says, well, that is something that I can do. We know what has to happen. Suborbital space tourism must be financially extremely successful, because then it will spawn the competition for orbitals and sending people to asteroids and Mars and so on.
Rutan's vision that we as a species will extend our reach far into space is, for me, thrilling. One of the companies developing suborbital tourism as the first step towards this is Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. Over 700 advanced tickets to space have been sold to what the company call their future astronauts. But it doesn't come cheap. Currently, $250,000 a trip. And the spaceship isn't ready yet for commercial operation.
We wanted to meet here to show you something pretty special. We are preparing for a flight, as you know, on Thursday, and we're pretty excited by that.
While they wait, future astronauts are invited to exclusive events to see the spaceship's progress.
So tonight we're going to see what is inside behind these great big hangar doors.
A plane with a twin fuselage holds a second craft under its wing.
The evolution of Burt Rutan's design is called Spaceship Two. Once released in mid-air from its large mothership, it will take up to 6 passengers on a suborbital flight to an altitude of 110 kilometres. Here, they will experience around 4 minutes of weightlessness and be able to see the curvature of the Earth below and the blackness of space above.
So I'm going to pass out some champagne. We'll have a toast to Unity.
Thank you for being fantastic future astronauts, for supporting us all the time and being wonderful. So cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Cheers.
The early customers expected to fly to space back in 2010.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maureen Gannon. I signed up to be a future astronaut, or just an astronaut, in 2006, I believe, before this one came along. So, you want to say anything?
I love space.
I love space.
I'm Alan Mark. I've had no interest in space at all. Hi. And then I heard how fast this is going to go. And that's what got me. I love fast. Fast. And when I heard how fast it was going, I said...
The ticket holders aren't the only ones with a keen eye on progress. Richard Branson has flown in overnight.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Richard.
Lovely to see you.
How are you?
Great. Do you want some toast?
I'd love some toast, yeah.
We first met when I was filming in Madagascar, and we share a passion for aviation. He's here to see a test flight of Spaceship Two, the latest in a long program to certify the craft for commercial use.
We try not to give dates, but we're hopeful that by the end of the year we'll finally be into space.
Brian and Richard walk through the hangar.
Morning.
It's already more than a decade since Spaceship One first reached space, and this time frame may still be optimistic. But the company employs 650 people and has spent well over $600 million trying to make commercial trips to space a reality.
Have you ever seen anything so sexy?
The pilot for Spaceship Two's test flight is Dave Mackay.
All right, Brian, would you like to see Spaceship?
I cannot wait.
Okay.
Follow me.
Even the future astronauts aren't being allowed inside Spaceship Two, as it's yet to be fitted out.
So you're now in the captain's seat.
This is a manual flight control vehicle, so rods, cables connecting the flight controls to the actual surfaces on the wing.
Yeah. Can I turn it? Oh, no.
Yeah, sure.
So if I go... Oh, yeah, and of course it's very light at the moment because we're in a hangar. And so you just go down. I can't tell you what... It's an experience, right? Anybody who's watching this who's an aviation geek will go, yeah, I had to do that, didn't I? Thank you.
Two more spaceships are already being built on the site to make up a fleet of three, ready for use soon after testing is complete. The design uses the latest lightweight carbon fibre composite materials.
Should I do that?
Yeah, go there.
Ow.
It also needs to be incredibly strong to cope with the stresses of spaceflight. Windows are a potential weak point, but space tourists are paying for the view.
So this is a window frame that we haven't put into one of our new spacecraft yet. So that's the main window. That's the size of it. It's about 17 inches across. Yeah. It's huge compared to an airliner window.
In a weightless environment, you actually need to control where you are relative to the window and hold yourself up to it. So there will be a little finger grab around the window that you only need just a little bit, your first knuckle almost, to be able to get around, and that's enough to hold yourself up against that window.
This Spaceship Two is in the finishing stage of its build, but Virgin Galactic have been here before. In 2010, the aerospace company which designed and built the first Spaceship Two began its test flight program. It progressed from simple glide flights to rocket-powered tests.
The rocket engine fires and leaves a long trail of dark smoke in the atmosphere.
And to raising the unique tail stabilization system. All was progressing well. But during the last powered test, on the 31st of October 2014, the control system allowed the co-pilot to release the tail too early in the flight.
The flight in progress, then a still of an explosion.
Within seconds, the spacecraft disintegrated. The lead pilot was thrown clear of the cockpit and managed to parachute to safety. But the co-pilot was killed.
Our primary thoughts at this moment are with the crew and family, and we're doing everything we can for them now.
You know, I think a lot about
that day and to make sure that we learn as much as we can, to make sure that our vehicle integrates the lessons from that so that it becomes a safer vehicle. And this goes back through the history of aviation, has made air flight or space flight safer, right? And how do you make it safer is you take that lesson and you integrate it into a future operation, and that's what we're trying to do.
George Whitesides, Virgin Galactic CEO.
Now, Virgin Galactic have taken over day-to-day running of the entire project. Over 2 years after the crash, the new Spaceship Two is early in its flight test program. Primed for today's flight, only critical personnel are allowed near it. There's no rocket engine attached yet, so it won't blast its way into space. Instead, Dave Mackay and his co-pilot will assess how the craft handles while on a glide from its mothership back to Earth. Virgin Galactic staff and their families have turned out to watch as the mothership begins its climb to 50,000 feet.
The craft takes off and flies overhead.
Oh my gosh, she's already up!
Spaceship Two rattles under the wing of the mothership.
Once its job is done, the mothership's pilots will fly it back to base to be reunited with the spaceship.
Do you have any nerves on these days?
Of course, because of what happened a couple of years ago, I think, you know, when you're going through a test program, it'd be very strange not to have nerves. And I'm sure that, you know, I've just been up with all the families and all their children, and they wouldn't be human if they didn't have a little bit of some nerves. Yeah, I'm nervous with them. But in the end, you can only test these things in the air and see how they work.
The mothership has reached the drop altitude. And in Spaceship Two, pilot Dave Mackay prepares to be released for the glide back to Earth.
3, 2, 1.
It drops away and begins to glide. The craft has a delta-shaped wing extending from the main body and is stabilized by two training surfaces with flared tail wings.
Oh, there it is, yeah. I can see it.
A support plane flies alongside it.
Spaceship Two proves its gliding ability. But the real test will be whether the rocket-powered flights, due to start in a few months, can take it safely to space.
Well done.
Okay, thanks. Dave. Look beautiful.
Very nice. Thanks. Yeah.
The plane is towed by an SUV.
I'm joining Branson as he visits the base in New Mexico, from where Virgin Galactic's customers will eventually fly to space. The journey is a chance to ask whether this project will really open up space for us all.
I suppose one of the problems at the moment is the expense level. I mean, $250,000 or something like that is certainly not for everybody. When do you think that future will unfold where it is routine people to fly?
The cost of our program has been a lot more than we thought. Once we got our investment back, once we've got, you know, a number of spaceships, I think we can start seeing the price coming down. And one day we could have, you know, 20 spaceships operating, and then, you know, the price could come down to a level where I think, you know, there would be much more demand than we can ever supply. So I think an enormous amount of people will be able to go into space.
But the place we're visiting stands as a reminder that, as yet, no one is flying on regular space tourism flights.
Here she comes.
A low building in the desert.
Spaceport America, the world's first commercial spaceport. It was designed by the British architect Norman Foster and cost over $200 million to build. Around two-thirds of this was from the taxpayers of the state of New Mexico.
The futuristic building has a sweeping roof and glass facade.
Wow. Look. It looks like a spaceship has landed.
The initial construction of the spaceport was completed in 2011. Lead tenants Virgin Galactic plan to use a fleet of spaceships to make daily flights to space from here. But the hangar remains empty, apart from a model of Spaceship Two.
That's just the most magnificent panorama.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was incredible that they've agreed to build all this.
Virgin Galactic are paying an annual rent of over $1 million. But without full operations, the spaceport is being paid for by the residents of New Mexico at around $500,000 a year. Some in the state are growing tired of waiting for the influx of space tourists and other paying tenants.
I suppose you've had a decade now from Spaceship One.
You know, I knew that space was difficult. I knew that rocket science was difficult. But, you know, I hadn't realised just how difficult it was.
The sun dips behind the roof.
While there will be more of a wait for Virgin Galactic to start operations, I think suborbital space tourism will inevitably become a reality. It may feel a long way from creating a space-faring civilization, but space tourism isn't the only game in town for commercial space companies. Virgin also plan to slash the cost of launching small satellites. An early project is to deliver communications infrastructure to the remotest parts of the world. And in Seattle, there's a man spending $1 billion of his own money a year on even more ambitious plans.
You know, I come by the space bug honestly. As a kid, I was inspired by the giant Saturn V missions that roared to life from these very shores.
Jeff Bezos has become the second richest man in the world through his canny ability to read the future. Back in 1994, he recognized the potential of the internet and started an online sales company in his garage. It's now the basis of his $80 billion fortune, Amazon.com.
A large warehouse.
Just down the road from Amazon, Bezos also has a rocket company. It's called Blue Origin, after the colour of our home planet.
I think it might be through there.
But it's so secretive, it doesn't even have a sign outside.
Yes, this is it.
We're one of the first film crews ever to be allowed in.
A rocket factory. Look at that, it's beautiful, isn't it? A production line for rockets and capsules.
Blue Origin are developing a vertical rocket with a passenger-carrying capsule, and like Virgin Galactic, hope to start taking tourists into space next year. Rockets are harder to land than a space plane, but they can send larger payloads deeper into space.
Hi.
Hello.
Jeff.
Brian.
Brian,
very
what a pleasure.
Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
How do you see the our future in space unfolding?
We need a dynamic entrepreneurial explosion in space, just as I've witnessed over the last 20 years on the internet. Thousands of companies and tens of thousands of startups and doing interesting things online. The reason that could happen is because they didn't have to do the heavy lifting infrastructure. The heavy lifting infrastructure was already in place. 20 years ago, I was driving the packages to the post office myself, and I didn't have to build the internet. That already existed. I didn't have to figure out how to transport parcels. There was the postal service and so on and so on. So that when heavy infrastructure is already in place, then the creativity of thousands of people can be unleashed. Right now, the price of admission is just so high that not very many people get to exercise their creativity in the domain of space. One of the big problems with lowering the cost of space launch today is that we just don't get enough practice. The most used launch vehicles fly, in a good year, maybe 10 or 12 times a year.
And you just never get truly great at anything you only do 10 or 12 times a year. So one of the great things about tourism is it could provide additional launches to drive up the rate of practice.
And lift off.
Developing their space tourism rocket has already proved a useful practice ground for Blue Origin.
Booster is now 250,000 feet.
You're going to see the landing gear deploy. This is the aft section of the new Shepard vehicle. So this section of the vehicle gets mounted onto the midsection.
In 2015, they made a groundbreaking step toward reusability. Using its engine and autonomously controlled thrusters, their rocket was landed back on its tail for the first time.
Welcome back, New Shepard.
The landing struts of a rocket are tested in a lab.
The idea that we used to throw these away.
Yes, it's heartbreaking. When you look at the precision of this aerospace quality hardware, and even you know, it's obviously very wasteful just financially, but it's also heartbreaking to put so much work into something and then only use it once.
Yeah. But what is all this practice for? Blue Origin have started work building a rocket that's more powerful than anything flying today. The New Glenn will be capable of carrying a payload of 45 tons into orbit. And the company already has a contract to deliver satellites. Could this be the next step towards the space infrastructure that Jeff argues is necessary?
It seems to me that there's an element of a stepping stone in it, in the sense that we're learning by practice, and you have an economic model which allows you to, I suppose, build these factories.
That's exactly right.
But what do you hoping happens to our civilization? Is this really, do you see it as a step towards a spacefaring civilization?
Yes, it is a step towards a spacefaring civilization. We have sent robotic probes now to every planet in the solar system, and we know without any shadow of a doubt that Earth is the best one. This is the best planet. Yeah. And we need to protect it. And the only way to really protect it is to eventually, you know, move heavy industry off Earth, and Earth can be effectively zoned, you know, residential and light industry.
You hear it a lot. Why don't we solve the problems on Earth before we go into space?
Right. It's part of the solution. You know, really, if you think about space, it's a much better place to do heavy manufacturing. In space, you have 24/7 solar power. The resources in space are much vaster in terms of mineral resources and so on. Every kind of element that you need is available in space in very large quantities. And so over the next couple of hundred years, that will allow us to both continue to have a dynamic, expanding, growing, thriving, interesting civilization, but while still protecting this planet that we evolved on, which is this jewel, this diamond of a planet.
This is a hugely ambitious and exciting vision. It's hard to put a timescale on it becoming a reality, but we do already have industry in space. Over 1,400 satellites circle above us, providing everything from land use data to TV broadcasts. And with the likes of Blue Origin promising more affordable access to space, there are already startup companies looking to capitalize.
What will tomorrow look like? Our world is at its limits. And yet we all want more. And why not? Why shouldn't the future be better than today? But where will it come from? Simple. Our tiny planet sits in a vast sea of resources. It's time someone seized the opportunity. Deep Space Industries.
This company plans to mine resources in space, and its chairman is Rick Tumlinson.
So you're talking about space mining, essentially, and refining those materials. That sounds like science fiction.
Our business plan for Deep Space is based on the fact that it's expensive to go into space. So we're going to go out there and harvest space resources. So when they arrive, we've got their supplies.
Tumlinson believes there's already a market to supply satellites and spaceships with resources found in space. His company has major investment from the government of Luxembourg and claims it will start delivering its services within a decade.
So we look at telecom satellites, telecommunication satellites. Well, these are billion-dollar spacecraft. Now, they have a need to be able to keep them up there as long as possible. So what about tugboats? What about refueling them? You know, what about being able to move them from one orbit to another and doing things like that?
So it's on-orbit servicing.
On-orbit servicing, yeah. Tugboat services, refueling services. These are the kinds of activities we're starting to look at right now. And there are real companies working on this. Our company's one of them, but there are others as well.
These companies plan to find resources on asteroids, the rocky leftovers from the birth of our solar system. There are millions of them, ranging from a few meters to hundreds of kilometers across. And some contain minerals ideal for taking space industry to the next level. Planetary Resources is a company backed by Silicon Valley billionaires. It is already testing satellites ready to prospect in space.
So the spacecraft like this, that size, would go to an asteroid in a few years, is the plan?
Yeah, this is the geologist that we'll send out to the future mine site on a near-Earth asteroid. Metallic asteroids really are going to be the stock that we will build out all the infrastructure in space, build a space station, a habitat, start manufacturing, being able to, you know, make more spaceships.
And how much of this is out there for us?
A mind-boggling amount. So if we looked at all the metal on the asteroids in the solar system, we're talking about enough metal to build an 8,000-story tall skyscraper that would cover the entire surface of the Earth. So that's a very, very big building indeed.
Imagining that, so it's an 8,000-story building across the entire surface area of the Earth.
Yeah, so I wouldn't recommend building it on the Earth. I would build it in space.
No, but it's enough to build anything we want.
Anything we want.
This may all sound rather far-fetched, but these startups are attracting investment from forward-thinking business minds for good reason. It's been estimated that mining a single asteroid could turn a profit of up to $30 billion. And we're already able to land on fast-moving pieces of rock in space. The European Space Agency's Rosetta mission did touch down on a comet.
Celebrations in flight control.
But it wasn't trying to bring anything back. And if you find space mining ambitious, there's another billionaire entrepreneur with an even bolder vision of our space-faring future.
A tall, broad-shouldered man.
Elon Musk made his fortune setting up the online payment company PayPal. He's become steadily more ambitious, from his radical shake-up of the car industry with his electric Tesla cars, to transforming the world's supply of rechargeable batteries with the largest factory ever built. And now he wants to take us into space with his company, SpaceX.
Landing struts extend out of a rocket as its engine slows its descent to a landing pad.
The company's milestones, like the first landing of an orbital rocket, have been witnessed by Tim Urban. He was approached by Musk to write about SpaceX and has the inside line on the firm's ambitions.
Joining him at a bar.
Hello. Brian.
Hey, good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Very good to meet you.
Yeah.
What's that, by the way?
Is that the SpaceX PA?
I love a SpaceX. One thing that struck me, because we've, I suppose what you might call the three big companies, SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, and Blue Origin. SpaceX is unusual, isn't it?
What SpaceX does now, right, the way they pay the bills, which is not their long-term goal, it's just the way they pay their bills on the way to the long-term goal, is they just deliver stuff to space.
Since SpaceX began in 2002, they've had their fair share of failures.
A rocket explodes in a ball of flame on a launch pad.
Most recently, losing a rocket during a launch pad test in 2016.
Secondary explosions send shockwaves through the fire.
But they have succeeded in developing a reusable rocket system that can put satellites into orbit and a capsule that can dock with the International Space Station.
Houston Station, looks like we got us a dragon by the tail.
It delivers NASA's cargo and soon their astronauts as well. And that's just the beginning of SpaceX's plans.
So there's what SpaceX does, and then there's what it really does. Now, what it really does is it innovates to try to revolutionize the cost of space travel in order to make humanity a spacefaring multiplanetary civilization, in order to build life insurance for the species and bring us to another level as a species. That's what it really does, the big picture.
Musk believes that in the long term, it is inevitable that we will face an extinction event, an asteroid strike, or perhaps a worldwide pandemic. Given this, he argues it only makes sense to ensure that some of us are living on another planet. And there's only one that's currently feasible.
A red plane.
Mars.
So the ambition is to build that rocket and send it to Mars.
To travel, it's going to...
5 years.
Yes, and if it's going to do that, then it has to do some flights around Earth first, so it's probably going to be built in the next 2 years, maybe 3 years, 7 years. This takes off with the Neil Armstrong of Mars in it. It's going to be the only thing we're talking about.
It's an astonishing vision.
It is. And again, you know, the skepticism, the cynicism I would have about, well, yeah, sure. When I saw them land a rocket, I said, they're now innocent until proven guilty. I am trusting SpaceX and their insane ambition until I see otherwise, because they keep doing what people say they can't do.
But the skepticism, I suppose, even I, who am absolutely optimistic, think that I would be delighted if that thing were flying within 5 years.
A very large rocket.
This does sound like a highly ambitious timescale. Not least because to date, there's only one organisation that has landed and operated anything successfully on Mars. NASA. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory is responsible for all of NASA's unmanned spacecraft and robots beyond Earth orbit. Its recent director, responsible for sending 24 missions into space, is Dr. Charles Ilarchi.
I love coming here because I've grown up with this.
Yeah.
You know, Voyager at Jupiter, Voyager at Saturn, New Horizons at Pluto. I can't stand here without looking at everything.
It is an amazing feat for humanity, for that matter, for our species, that in the last few decades we have visited every part of our solar system.
Dr. Ilarchi oversaw the landing of their most recent rover, named Curiosity, on Mars in 2012.
A delivery vehicle makes tiny adjustments to its trajectory in Mars's atmosphere.
So Mars brings a different challenge because it's a very thin atmosphere. On Mars, you need the parachute, but then we need to do the retro rocket.
Retro rockets burn beneath the rover.
To slow us even further and then effectively hovers. And then we do the sky crane. Slowly land the rover on the surface.
The sky crane disconnects and flies away. Then Curiosity starts up.
JPL's Mars rovers have sent back invaluable data on the makeup of the planet's atmosphere and geology. And most significantly, confirmed that there is ice on Mars, meaning water would be available to support a future colony. NASA do have plans for humans to follow their rovers to Mars, currently scheduled for the 2030s. But could commercial companies beat them to it?
We know what it takes to land on Mars, you know, because here at JPL, we landed the last four missions successfully. It's not easy. It's very challenging. And then when you move to the human, it adds additional challenge of the long travel. I mean, you're talking about, with today's technology, about 2 years round trip. If you want to send a human to Mars, I think it's going to be a national endeavor, you know, at the beginning, because it really involved a significant amount of investment. And it's being done for both scientific and human exploration. To move it to a profitable commercial endeavor, it's going to take a while.
Essentially, what you're saying is no company will make an investment to go and open up Mars because it's just too, it's too expensive.
In the Earth orbit, for activity in Earth orbit, the commercial sector can do most of the things, you know, in Earth orbit, and we rely on that. The next step is going to be asteroid and the moon thing, and I think we're almost there for the commercial sector to be able, step by step. Going to Mars is still a big challenge.
Curiosity's mast camera.
Given the level of challenge that Mars presents, I want to find out why Elon Musk is so convinced that he can make us an interplanetary species within such a short timescale. The man who helped win him round to the idea back in 2000 is aerospace engineer and Mars exponent Robert Zubrin.
Okay, so here's my lab. This machine here is one of the most important. This is for making rocket fuel and oxygen on Mars out of the Martian atmosphere.
Since the 1990s, Zubrin's proposal of a lightweight, live-off-the-land approach to visiting Mars has influenced many, including NASA.
So then this is really a lab aimed at ultimately colonizing and building bases, creating resources out of raw material and staying there.
Yes. This is my invention for cleaning clothes in space. I call it the vacuum cleaner. It sucks out all the air, it boils off all the water and all the oils, it explodes all the bacteria, they're dead, the stuff is clean.
Some of Zubrin's ideas may seem unconventional, but it's his back-to-basics approach that has proved so appealing.
Can you give us some indication of the difficulty of humans going to Mars and then colonizing? Because you've got these wonderful paintings on the wall.
This is a depiction of my mission plan for human exploration of Mars, which is known as the Mars Direct Plan. There's nothing in this that's fundamentally beyond our technology. We're not talking about venturing into new and unknown worlds of physics here. We're talking about brass tacks engineering, building systems of moderate size, flying them to Mars. We do not need giant Battlestar Galactica spaceships.
How optimistic are you that this is, there's something different now in 2017 to the way the world was in, let's say, the year 2000?
In the year 2000, we knew about people like Elon Musk. They were characters in science fiction stories of the entrepreneur who would come along and make this happen. Well, now, those characters have stepped out of science fiction novels and they are now in the real world doing this stuff.
Zubrin's zeal for finding a way to reach Mars is driven by a belief that it is the only option humanity has to ensure its long-term survival.
And the worst idea that anybody has ever had is that there is only so much to go around, okay? And that therefore nations are all enemies of each other. If we can get off this rock and see that the world we live in is not this planet, this is not the world, this is just one planet in a world of trillions of planets, and that there are unlimited resources available to us if we maximize the reach of human creativity, and therefore every nation is fundamentally the friend of every nation and every person of every other person.
a desert road.
Having been inspired by people like Robert Zubrin, Elon Musk does seem to be bringing our ability to reach Mars closer. But there remains a significant barrier to establishing a colony. How will we humans cope physically and mentally? Zubrin's Mars Society has an experiment based on his Mars Direct plan, deep in the Utah desert. This is the road to a Mars analog station. What they're doing out here is they're simulating living on Mars as closely as they can. And so what they've done, apparently, is that they've left a spacesuit and a backpack and a helmet and a radio system and all the things you would have if you're living on Mars out in the desert. And I've got to stop the car, put it on, and go into full simulation mode because they live there for weeks at a time. And the job is to practice being a settler on Mars. And to be honest, it doesn't look too dissimilar to Mars.
Brian suits up.
Excellent. I assume that on the actual mission, we've been trained to do this. Yeah.
Humans on a mission to Mars would have to endure close confinement with their crew members, along with extreme isolation from the rest of humanity.
Hi, Brian, we see you walking towards us. Do you copy?
And the minimum mission length would be around 2 years.
Yes, I do copy. Want me to approach the airlock and get in? Over.
Exactly, over.
This crew habitation module has been built to explore these psychological pressures, as well as the practical challenges. And the major donor to fund its construction? Elon Musk.
A man behind an airlock door.
I see you're all in the airlock and the door is closed, so I'll start pressurization, so 3 minutes.
The current inhabitants, engineering students from France and Belgium, are 2.5 weeks into their 3-week simulation.
In reality, on Mars, the air would be rushing in now, the pressure would be rising.
Like every crew that stays, they undergo psychological assessment throughout.
And 3 minutes.
A student's holding a card with Brian's name on.
Aha. Welcome on Mars.
Thank you very much. Ah, thank you.
Fresh hair.
Yeah.
The bottom deck of the hab is for experiments, equipment, and other essentials.
So we only flush when strictly necessary.
On the top deck is the accommodation for the 7 crew.
This is my room, and since I'm executive officer, it's slightly bigger than the others because I get the curve. The others just have a wall. So.
Oh, wow. Can I go in?
Yeah, sure.
You really get a sense. It'd be a psychological challenge to live here for years, wouldn't it?
Also in the living area is an experimental plant nursery tended by crew biologist Victoria.
Every day we are happy to see this because all over the station it's red, grey, we don't have green things.
Oh, so it helps psychologically as well just to see
I think it's
plants growing, just seeing green.
Yeah.
Life on Mars would be incredibly tough.
A high-altitude balloon.
Temperatures on the red planet are regularly minus 80 degrees Celsius. There's almost no oxygen, and humans would be bombarded by cosmic radiation. And to think the Utah desert feels tough.
It gets increasingly uncomfortable in a spacesuit, which is the point of the simulation. You get a real feel for how difficult it would be to perform even quite simple tasks on the Martian surface.
The risks for anyone willing to go to Mars would be immense. But if Elon Musk succeeds in his plans, it could be ordinary citizens like these young scientists and engineers that are given the opportunity to go.
Do you think that your generation is more interested now in Mars, in spaceflight, than the previous generations stretching back probably to the end of Apollo?
If you just asked me to go to space for 2 years now, I would say yes, immediately.
Would anyone not do it? Would anyone think that's a very like a 3-year trip in something probably smaller than this and rather more difficult than this? Would anybody not do it?
I think it depends a lot on the fine print of the contract. Like if it's a one-way mission, I think a lot of it was give it a lot more thought. If it's like come back with what probability, also what is the exact duration of the mission, that kind of parameters will probably help everyone make a decision. But I think as of right now, if you say, okay, let's go, it takes 2 years.
Thanks. See ya.
Have a safe trip.
Spaceship Two released from beneath its mothership, then Blue Origin's rocket launching from a pad.
And liftoff.
Tim Urban in the bar.
Meeting the commercial space companies and the young generation they're influencing has been exciting and, I would say, inspiring. I've seen engineering right at the cutting edge of our capabilities, driven by an ambitious and positive vision of our future.
Humanity as a species, we have to go into space, I mean, in my view. And so that leads you with only two options. Either we need to expand out into the solar system if we want to continue to grow, or you have to enter a period of stasis. And I know which of those two options I think is more interesting.
And our environment is not just the Earth. Our environment is the solar system. By expanding humanity's capability in this way, we are assuring or doing our best to assure the survival of our species and of our civilization.
Private rocket ships.
We're talking about commercial companies here, whether they're into space tourism, industry in space, or sending us to Mars. And of course, they have an eye on making money. As their projects develop, it is vital that we ask searching questions. But I've been struck by the conviction I've encountered. And I think they are addressing the most important challenge of our time. Having had the privilege of making this film, speaking to so many of the people who are trying to push the boundaries and to try to turn us into a spacefaring civilization, I would say that I am more optimistic than ever, actually, about the future of the human race. Because I think we are on the verge of finally leaving this planet and making a home amongst the stars. I really mean that. I think that's what I've learnt. And that is surely a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful time to be alive.
In his spacesuit in Utah.
Would you like to learn more about the UK's part in the race into space? Delve deeper into both human and robotic exploration. Go to the website at the bottom of the screen and follow the links to the Open University.